There was never a shortage of scary consequences to drug addiction, but in recent years, more and more fentanyl is flooding black markets, and that synthetic opioid, 50 to 100 times more potent than morphine, has the potential to do something bizarre and devastating to the brain, effectively scorching the hippocampus so that some overdose survivors are left unable to form new memories, perhaps for the rest of their lives. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. That kind of brain damage is hard to fathom on a personal level, and actually it remains quite a puzzle for doctors as well. But as my guest will tell us, scientists have long relied on patients with unusual kinds of brain damage to help them understand how healthy brains work, and research into drug-related brain damage might also have implications for the study and treatment of memory diseases like Alzheimer's. Lauren Aguirre is a science journalist. Her book is called The Memory Thief and the Secrets Behind How We Remember, A Medical Mystery. Lauren, welcome to Think.
Hi, thank you. I'm so happy to be here today.
So you developed a particular interest in stories about memory because you actually experienced a kind of sudden onset, thankfully temporary, bout of amnesia. What happened to you?
Well, I was just sitting there on an otherwise unremarkable morning. Everyone was asleep and I was working on my laptop, and suddenly this feeling of dread kind of swept over me. And at the same time, all my memories vanished. So I looked around the room and I thought, where am I? And, you know, what year is it? What time is it? But worst of all, who am I? If you had walked into the room at that moment and asked me my name, I could not have told you. And it was so frightening to not have any sense of connection to the world and no sense of who I was. I just lay face down on the floor for a few minutes until it passed. But fortunately, as you say, it was temporary, and it turned out to be a sort of brain lesion. And I had lots of opinions about what I should do, including a neurosurgeon telling me I should have surgery. So I was already primed to care about memory beyond sort of the normal, oh, it's annoying when I can't remember someone's name. But beyond that, it really gave me a sense of how terrifying it is to not know what happened to you, which is the case of people who suffer this rare amnestic syndrome.
You open the book with the story of a young man named Owen, who was an insurance broker who had been an unusually good student, but for one thing, suffered from this persistent, seemingly irrational fear of forgetting. What is his story?
So he began using drugs at a very early age, kind of the classic story of found some Vicodin in a friend's medicine cabinet. And so from the age of 11 onwards, he used many, many drugs. And a lot of opioids, progressed to heroin, and then ultimately to fentanyl. And at some point along the way, he really began to worry about losing his memory, even though, you know, by all outward appearances, he had no memory problems. He was an exceptional student. He graduated 4.0 from a prestigious university, and ironically enough, studied the neurobiology of memory. So he was always fascinated with memory. But for him, it was also sort of a debilitating fascination because he was so afraid of it that he spent hours every day writing in his journals and creating long to-do lists and then reorganizing those to-do lists. So for him, at that point in his life, it was really sort of a misery and contributed to a lot of his depression. After a lot of struggle, he eventually was successful in being at least sober for 18 months. And then through a truly incredible series of events, he started to smell a strange burning smell that no one else could smell. So his doctor suspected a tumor, sent him for a scan, and Owen, most of us would be terrified, Owen was ecstatic because for him that meant he now had an excuse to go back to using fentanyl. No one would be mad at him if he did. So he was just very happy and waiting for confirmation that that was indeed the case, that he had a tumor. And then one night he got an email saying, actually, it was a mistake and you're fine. And he was so devastated that he went on Craigslist, found fentanyl, went and got it, and overdosed. And when he woke up, his fear had actually become his reality. And he He could not remember anything for more than 30 seconds.
You describe the situation in the hospital. His family's there, his doctor is there, and he keeps asking the same questions in a way that, if it weren't so terrifying, would almost be funny.
Yes. So, for example, his doctor happened to be wearing a pair of shoes that he also had, Doc Martens. So, you know, the doctor would walk into the room and Owen would say, "Oh, you're wearing Doc Martens. I have those." And the doctor would say, "Oh, yeah." And then by the time he'd walked around the bed, the end of the bed where the shoes went out of view, by the time the shoes came back into view, Owen would say, "Oh, wow, you have Doc Martens. I have those too."
And how old was he at the time? 24, 26?
24.
Huh.
24.
So they discovered with brain scans that his hippocampus was essentially gone, destroyed, right?
Well, not gone, but extremely damaged. So this type of brain scan taken right after the injury will show the hippocampus and the hippocampus alone as sort of glowing really brightly against the back of the background of the rest of the brain. And when it glows like that, it means that there's damage. You can't tell how many neurons have died, but this is what it will look like in someone who's had a stroke, but it won't cover an entire brain region. It'll be little dots of dead or dying neurons here and there. So this was a very, very unusual pattern. As Jed Barish, who was one of the first neurologists to see a patient, said, it was sort of like someone took a page out of his neuroanatomy textbook and deliberately colored in the hippocampus.
Jed Barish is such an interesting guy because no rash of strange medical cases can be examined and understood before somebody bothers to notice they're happening. What was the first such case that came to his attention?
So that was a young man named Max Meehan, who in 2012 overdosed on what he thought was heroin. And when he woke up, it was the same situation as with Owen. You know, he couldn't figure out what had happened. And he had probably fallen asleep on one leg, which had fallen, the leg had fallen asleep. So he kept, you know, getting up but falling down, getting up but falling down. And it just, nothing made sense. He kept asking the same questions and he thought he was dying. So he went to the hospital and it was the same thing. They saw the MRI scan, but they couldn't make sense of it because they hadn't seen anything like it before. But he had the same really, really what they call dense amnesia. So they too had to sort of send him home without a diagnosis. So that was the first patient in 2012. And, you know, with one patient, it's pretty hard to tell what's going on. So they talked about it. Should we write up a case report? But of course, you know, everyone's busy. So they all filed it away in the back of their minds. And it wasn't until another patient in early 2015 came to Jed Barish at Lahey Hospital in Burlington, Massachusetts, who also had exactly the same pattern on his brain scan and the same problem of amnesia. And this was 2 months later. So he was coming with his wife and his mother to try to understand what was happening. So now there were two patients and the common link seemed to be heroin. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to ask if you could pull back for a minute and explain like how exactly this amnesia worked for these patients who were all suffering the same thing. They could remember their lives before their incidents, accidents, injuries. They couldn't make new memories after.
That's right. So it's called anterograde amnesia. So you remember your whole past. You know who your mother is. You know what your name is. But you can't lay down any new memories. So you are sort of stuck in this perpetual and pretty scary permanent present while everything keeps moving on without you. So, for example, with Owen, it became kind of difficult for him to spend time with friends after he got out of the hospital because he wouldn't remember what had happened that was important in their lives. And he was afraid he'd ask about a girlfriend who, you know, the person had just broken up with the girlfriend. So it's very difficult in that way.
So every
and also,
oh, please continue. Sorry.
You can't. You also can't remember new rules. So, for example, the first day that I met Owen in person, we drove around and we stopped at a coffee shop and he said, "Do you want to play Scrabble?" Well, he had only ever played on his phone, so he hadn't had to pay attention to the rules. But so every turn he had to ask me how many letters in the tray. But his memory for words was fully intact and he beat me at Scrabble. So that's the kind of difference.
Many people will know that an early sign of Alzheimer's can be getting lost in what had been familiar places or forgetting to do things that we normally do at a certain time of day, like eat. What might that suggest about the way the disease affects the hippocampus?
So we do know that in most cases of Alzheimer's disease, the damage starts in the hippocampus. So it does make sense that those sorts of memory lapses are the first indications that something is wrong. But from there, the damage does spread out into other brain areas, which is why, as it progresses, people begin to have trouble with planning, with speech, with concentrating, with paying attention, and ultimately with moving.
So the cases that Jed Barish and his colleagues started to notice had a common thread, which was drug use. They weren't entirely sure right away which drug, because lots of people who abuse drugs use several different ones. But we should talk for a minute here about how a synthetic like fentanyl compares with poppy-derived opioids. It's much, much stronger. What was its intended medical use before it became a drug of abuse?
So it was actually designed to be a part of a mix of drugs that are given during anesthesia and to be better than morphine or heroin by actually acting more quickly. And this would give anesthesiologists better control over how long the patient was under. So they were looking for something very potent and very fast acting. But even the FDA realized at the time that they approved it, which was in the early 1970s, that there was a lot of abuse potential. And in fact, anesthesiologists were among the first to do so. So they initially actually only approved it when mixed with a certain drug that made it less likely to be abused.
Had memory problems been reported in people coming out of surgical anesthesia?
So they have been, and it seems to be more likely in older people who are already at risk of memory loss. And it is fairly common right after surgery for this to happen. For some older people, it can last for months. And for some people, maybe 1% of people, it can be much longer lasting. But it's hard to know exactly what's responsible because the stress of surgery itself could be part of the problem. But no one has ever looked at fentanyl, which is surprising given that it's used in 80 to 90% of surgeries.
So Jed Barish recruited a resident named Monroe Butler to look at some of these cases with him. And you note that Barish was really gifted at spotting patterns in disparate cases. Butler's interest was figuring out why those patterns might occur. It seems like that would make them the perfect collaborative team.
They were the perfect match, and it really highlights the role of serendipity in how medical science advances. So Monroe Butler just has an incredible fund of knowledge and quite a good memory. So he immediately made the connection with another case of drug abuse in the 1980s, people who used the same batch of synthetic heroin that was contaminated with a contaminant that targeted a different brain region that's responsible for Parkinson's disease, or when it's damaged, that's when you get the symptoms of Parkinson's disease. So Monroe Butler immediately pointed that out to Jed Barish and said, if we could figure out what drugs these people are taking, maybe that could help us come up with a new way of understanding how the hippocampus can be damaged, because the synthetic heroin story back in the 80s actually led to the first animal model, mouse model for Parkinson's. And when you have a mouse model for a disease, that's how you test new treatments.
Do people who have other susceptibility, genetic susceptibility to things like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's, are they more likely to experience these drug effects as well?
That is unknown. And one of the reasons that it's so hard to study this is because there are so few patients, and they don't really have a handle on how many patients, because this is a stigmatized population who, you know, they may well be, their confusion may be chalked up to post-overdose effects. And of the 14 who were initially identified in Massachusetts, almost all of them died or disappeared. Mm-hmm. So Owen Rivers, who we talked about earlier, he actually agreed to participate in research. But you can't tell anything about genetics from one or two people. You would need a much bigger population sample. But it certainly is one of several possible explanations for why this happens to only a tiny percentage of people.
What have scientists learned about the nature of addiction that implicates learning and memory glitches or problems in getting people hooked in the first place?
So addiction is such a complex disorder, and you can look at it from many different lenses. You know, it's certainly a disease in the sense that there are genetic risks, and you can see changes in the brain, in its structure and its function. But you can also think of it as a disorder of learning and memory, because you're learning that a drug makes you feel a certain way. And ultimately, you learn that certain cues predict that you're going to feel that way. Like, you know, the strike of a match, you'll sort of predict, oh, I'm going to be smoking a cigarette soon or what have you. So, you know, all of these drugs release a molecule called dopamine into the synapses. And people used to call it kind of the pleasure molecule, but it's really more of a molecule that says, pay attention, there's something really important happening here. And that attention speeds up learning and memory. But theoretically, anything that you learn can be unlearned or modified. So some of the very early experimental work that's being done to try to treat addiction through learning and memory is to find a way to destabilize those memories and kind of break that connection between the cue and the desire to use the drug.
How might that work?
So one experiment that I covered in the book was this was to treat alcohol abuse. And so the researcher had people, they went through this sort of crazy setup where they were told they should drink some beer. And then they drank the beer and they had all these other cues, you know, pictures of beer. So all of that, their minds were in the beer state. And then the next day they had them come back and do all of that. But then when they were told to drink the beer, they didn't get to drink it. You know, they were told, pick up the beer, prepare to drink, and then they didn't get to drink it. And then at the same time, they gave them a drug that destabilizes memory formation. So that memory was sort of contaminated by this new experience that broke the association between the cue and the drinking. And he did a follow-up experiment where it was sort of exposed to aversive things. So they were told to drink and then exposed to bitter tastes. And both of those had, you know, were surprisingly effective in making those people less likely to keep on drinking heavily.
All right, let's go to the phones. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. We have Gary calling us from Beaumont, Texas. Hi, Gary.
Hi there. How are you?
Very well, thanks.
My question was on somewhere around 5 to 7 years ago, the medical community and I think even the FDA was in on releasing a list of drugs that seemed to have strong correlation to dementia and Alzheimer's patients if taken over a long period of time. And they were common over-the-counter drugs that the biggest name was Benadryl. What do you know about those drugs? There were several others. I can't remember all of the different ones, but a long list of just over-the-counter drugs that strongly correlate to people developing Alzheimer's and dementia later.
Thanks for calling.
Yeah, so I'm not aware of that list, but I will say, you know, that gets to the problem at the heart of figuring out what causes Alzheimer's or other dementias, which is, you know, were people who were taking these drugs, were they taking Benadryl because they had some health condition that increases your risk of Alzheimer's rather than the Benadryl itself being the problem?
Lauren, you mentioned a few minutes ago that Alzheimer's may begin in the hippocampus, but eventually spreads throughout other parts of the brain. What does it look like in the brain? And we should note that these effects can only be studied in depth after a patient has died, right?
Well, actually, it's one of the key advances in Alzheimer's research that you can now see this in the brain with PET imaging. So a certain kind of imaging that attaches a tracer to the protein. So there are two hallmark signs of Alzheimer's in the brain, two toxic proteins. And one is amyloid beta plaques, and the other are tau tangles. So the amyloid beta actually accumulate first in outer areas of the brain, and the tau tangles accumulate sort of in the gateway to the hippocampus. But when amyloid beta spreads down into the hippocampus and meets up with tau, that's when you begin to have memory impairments. And from there, the tau tangles spread outward to other brain areas. So it's the tau tangles that really track with the spread of the disease and the damage and the symptoms that people experience.
But it's still hard to know precisely when Alzheimer's begins for people. That's just decided based on symptoms.
Yes, but again, and this will be really revolutionary in the search for a treatment for Alzheimer's. New blood biomarker tests are coming online where you can, for example, and this isn't FDA approved yet, but where you can actually sample the blood and look for tau. And if you're seeing it in the blood, then it means that it's in the brain, and it's in the brain potentially at levels that are a precursor to someone developing Alzheimer's. So, but you're right in terms of it starts early. It could be 10, it could be 20. You know, I saw a report recently that maybe someone as young as in their 30s who isn't going to go on to actually have the disease until their 70s has early markers of Alzheimer's disease.
There have previously been a lot of false starts with therapies that worked somewhat for lab animals and not for humans. Of course, we understand that mouse brains and human brains are not exactly the same. But what else might account for why promising animal studies have not translated very well to human subjects?
Yes, someone told me they call it Mouseheimer's, and it's really not the same disease. I mean, part of it is goes back to not knowing what causes it. So if you want to make an animal model for a disease, you have to decide, well, what is the disease? And so if you make a mouse model based on the idea that amyloid plaques are the problem, and you make that mouse churn out a ton of amyloid plaques, and then you remove the amyloid plaques, you know, the mice actually did seem to get better. They don't actually know why that worked in people. But Alzheimer's is probably one of the most complicated brain diseases there is. And there are probably many, many on-ramps to it. There isn't necessarily one type of Alzheimer's. So now researchers are developing mouse models that are much more complex and that integrate, you know, multiple possible pathways to the disease. So, you know, the hope is that they will do a better job of modeling the disease, and perhaps lead to better clinical trials down the line.
Why are mice the lab animal of choice here? Does it have to do with their short lifespans and the ease of sort of studying multiple generations of them?
There's that, and also they're much less expensive. Like even rats are much more expensive compared to mice. So that's probably one of the biggest concerns. And then, of course, you know, with mice, they're small. You can totally control their environment, how much they sleep, how much they eat. So it's really that control so that you can look at what are the factors that you want to test and make sure that there aren't other things that are distorting your results.
All right, I want to go back to the phones. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Cheryl is on the line in Wiley, Texas. Hi, Cheryl.
Hi there.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Yeah, my question is, I work in a trauma intensive care unit, and we have patients who are often on a fentanyl drip, continuous infusion for many, many weeks at a time. And I wonder, after they come off that medication, should we be looking at their memory, and should we be doing some kind of a scan to assess their brain at that time?
Thanks for calling.
Oh, well, of course, I'm not a doctor, so I can't say what should happen. I will say, to sort of allay people's concerns about surgery, that fentanyl is usually given with another drug that would counteract these toxic effects that happen in the victims with the amnestic syndrome, and also that this really only happens to a tiny percentage of people. So, you know, if it's a problem, it's not a problem on a broad scale. But, you know, it doesn't sound like a bad idea to test someone's memory after they come off a long period of being on a drug, especially if they're sort of subjectively complaining.
How confident are researchers that something about fentanyl itself is the culprit here, rather than this being the result of like adulterated, you know, street drugs, things that got mixed wrong? People don't necessarily know what they're buying.
That's true. But if it were a toxic contaminant, then you would expect a situation like what happened in the 1980s, where you would see a cluster of people all at the same time who all developed this. And that's not the case here. These cases go back and to beginning in 2012 or possibly earlier, you know, all over the country in, you know, maybe 20 or so states. They've seen them in Canada, some potentially in Europe and South America. And so far apart geographically and in time, that doesn't point to a contaminant. And another reason they don't think it's a contaminant is because there was a case in Canada of a woman who used fentanyl patches prescribed for pain. She used them incorrectly. She used two instead of one, but she also developed this syndrome. And there was, you know, that was pharmaceutical grade fentanyl.
I want to go back to Owen, the first person that you profile in the book, who had this longstanding fear of losing his memory and then had this drug-induced accident in which he did lose his memory. This, of course, could be just a terrible coincidence. Could it also signal maybe in his earlier years of drug use, he was losing some capacity, but it was sort of subclinical and even he didn't realize it was happening?
Yes. That certainly is possible. And he would still be able to do well because he was so organized and, you know, probably had a lot of cognitive reserve. And he also, you know, because he studied memory, he used all these memory tricks. You know, he had a trick where when he studied for an exam, he would spray a little sticky note with a cologne and smell it. And then he'd go and take the test and he'd smell that sticky thing again and it would help reactivate all his memories. So he was very smart about how to overcome what he thought was a possible memory impairment.
We all like to think we're too smart to get addicted to drugs, but a story like Owen's proves that it really has nothing to do with that. I mean, any one of us is potentially susceptible.
That's true. Absolutely.
So, if we don't yet have any good way to reverse brain damage, certainly to reverse the effects of Alzheimer's after they begin to hinder us, what do we know about protecting our brains in advance?
So for now, it's the kind of thing that your mother would have told you, like exercise, get a lot of sleep, make sure you eat really well. And there is a lot of evidence that things like exercise, good diet, and generally taking care of your health is going to reduce your risk for Alzheimer's. You know, a healthy body is a healthy brain. And in terms of learning, it's not going to be things like playing Sudoku over and over again. It's actually learning like the hard stuff, like learning a new language or learning how to play an instrument. You know, but it doesn't have to be that dramatic, but basically you're challenging yourself in the same way that when you exercise, you want to challenge yourself.
Do you have any sense that, I mean, all of these things are available to just about all of us, but we would rather hear that there's a pill on the market that we can take to prevent this. Any sense of why that's the case?
You know, I think that's human nature. It is kind of crazy that you could do all this stuff for free that is good for you. But there's also this, you could take a drug that costs $56,000 a year and somehow that makes more sense. Again, I think that goes back to human nature, but there's really no downside to taking care of yourself. And it doesn't sound high tech. So maybe that's why people don't do it. I don't know.
Lauren Aguirre is a science journalist. Her book is called The Memory Thief and the Secrets Behind How We Remember, a Medical Mystery. Lauren, thanks very much for making time for us today.
Oh, thank you. It was great being here.
Think is a production of KERA in Dallas. Our team includes Stephen Becker, Paige Phelps, Ana Perez, Nilofer Arsala, and Micaela Rodriguez. Our interns are Angelica Perez, Tammy George, and Marissa Green. You can listen to Think wherever you listen to podcasts. I'm Chris Boyd. Have a great day.